Thank you for coming.
Thank you for coming out. Welcome. My name is Dub Swineblatt. My pronouns are they, them, theirs. And I'm so excited to be here for our seventh season of the Thank You for Coming Out podcast. In 2015, I founded the queer improv show, Thank You for Coming Out, or TIFCO, as we call it. And it was one of the longest running queer improv shows in New York City. In 2018, our beloved improv show became the podcast it is today, hosted and produced by Gay City News. It is an honor to hold space for the coming out and coming into self stories our guests share every week, and I'm so excited about my guest here with me today. Sammy Lopez, he, him, is a Tony Award-winning theater maker and co-founder of P3 Productions, dedicated to uplifting historically excluded voices through the arts. His producing credits include How to Dance in Ohio, Job, and the upcoming Broadway production Call Me Izzy, starring Jean Smart, playing at Studio 54 for 12 weeks only, beginning May 24th. This summer, he is also producing Pride Plays, a festival celebrating queer stories and emerging voices, with programming in both Washington, D.C., with Willie Mammoth for World Pride from June 3rd to 6th, and New York City, Rattlestick Theater, on June 23rd. So mark your calendars for all those important dates, everybody. Sammy, welcome.
Hello. I'm so excited to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh my gosh, a pleasure. I'm so excited that you're here. I feel like this has been like almost to say years in the making to have you come on here.
It truly has. And I feel like finally the stars have aligned for us to get on Zoom together and share stories.
I know. It's so lovely. And we also just saw a show. I keep thinking about it. So we saw a show recently together, Purpose.
Oh, so beautiful. I'm still thinking about it.
I know. Okay, so I'm thinking about the show still, and I'm thinking about how we couldn't find anywhere to eat before. It was like, what is happening? Like, we went to four different places, and
New York
impossible.
Is back, baby.
New York is back. And we walked by on a gas tire, or she walked by us.
Yes.
Which was such a New York moment. And then we're sitting in the theater and I was like, is that Sarah Paulson? And you're like, it is. And then we went on with our lives, but like it was such a New York evening. And I loved that we got to do that together.
Yeah. It was the epitome of a New York evening. And then also that play was 3 hours long, but like truly flew by, and it just got, was awarded the Pulitzer Prize for drama this year. This past week, and I felt so excited and connected to that news, because I felt like we had such like a magical evening at the show. And so I always love when good stories get the recognition, and you can just feel it in that the audience that evening, that everyone was on the ride of that show. It's just it was a really special moment for us.
Yeah, it was. And yeah, when you said it was 3 hours, I didn't even realize it was that long, because it really did fly by. It was so engaging.
Yeah, well, I think so much of the specificity of that story actually makes it so universal, and the ability to connect to it. And I think that's why I'm still thinking about it. And that's why I'm really interested in making stories that people who might not necessarily see themselves in someone else's lived experience could have that window into their lives, and that play really did that for me.
Yeah, I love that you just said that, because I feel in the seven seasons that I've been doing this podcast, I've interviewed, you know, so many people with all different kinds of identities and lived experiences that either are like identical to mine or completely different from mine. And I still, every episode, every conversation, I feel so connected to my guest, and there's like so much overlap, even if we don't share aspects of our identity. So to your point, There's so much connection to be made if only people were to allow it to happen through art, through conversation. So I love the work that you're doing to help propel those conversations.
Thank you. Yes. And I think that it's opportunities like this of like a shared space to be able to talk about it. And I think the only way that we as storytellers can kind of support society in becoming a better version of itself is through this type of shared opportunity to communicate and use the power of words to make our own experiences amplified in ways that I think traditionally have been silenced. And so I think this type of podcast is critical and necessary for individuals to continue to evolve and grow.
Thank you. I take that in my heart. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
So speaking of the podcast, we all have multiple coming out stories, multiple coming to ourselves stories, and I'd love to hear one of those that you'd like to share with us.
Yes, I mean, I have I was thinking about this quite a bit because I think there's something so kind of in moments when you do come into yourself or come out externally to the world, there's this level of pressure that I remember feeling so deeply before I came out to my family. And I will never forget, it was Thanksgiving of my freshman year of college, and I was at my sister's house. And of course, as a dramatic theater major, I decided to do it on a holiday. And but I shared with my family that I, was seeing a man, and it was an it really exciting moment where it was the first time I wanted to share this with you all. And my I think there were various initial responses with my family. I grew up in a very large Mexican family with a strong Catholic background, and so I didn't really know what to expect. But my dad, immediately lifted his glass and said, "There's." With all of my kids, you're the only one who's had to tell me, or felt like they needed to tell me, the type of relationship that they preferred in their life. And I just think of all of my kids, I just toast to your bravery and the ability that you can, share this with us, and we appreciate that. And it was just the response that I, did not expect, and I feel very grateful that that was the initial response of my dad. And of course, there was many years of like growth of comfortability and understanding how to then talk about my queerness to the rest of my larger family. But having that simple gesture of a toast of celebration and not letting it be baked in, I think what sometimes we see in media or in society in general, I felt like that's why I want to carry that type of sense of celebration forward of how do we continue to bring joy into the queerness that we bring into all things we do.
Wow. Thank you so much for sharing that. It's makes me just my heart melt that that was the reaction. Because I could imagine, I think part of what is so scary for so many queer people for in coming out is just not knowing how the other person's gonna react to our news. Like even if we are so whether or not we are comfortable or confident in who we are, it still is What's the word I'm looking for? Well, the word that's coming to mind is crapshoot. When
Yeah.
when we tell people that we care about, because you just don't know. And so I'm really just floored by this reaction from your dad. That's
Yeah.
incredible.
Yeah, and my family, we are very, all of my siblings, we have very different paths. We all are in very different industries. And I think as a theater person, we are in such a tight little niche of like, in order to be a theater person, there's so much of like empathy-led energy that you bring to a space. Like, I'm a person that like I want to hug you the f moment I see you. Like, I want to know what's going on, and there's so much curiosity that comes with, I think, the work that we do. And so when I'm with my larger family or with relatives or extended family friends, like I get reminded that, oh, like we are so lucky to be in this community of storytellers or people that respect art or culture. And so just the fact that that was the way in which my dad initially approached all of this, it really opened up the opportunity for conversation and to kind of demystify some of the stereotypes that I think we are labeled as queer people. And especially at the time in which this all went down, which was now I think like 16 or 17 years ago for me. So it was like it's amazing to also reflect on that number and be like, oh wow, like I have stood proudly in myself for in ways only like 15, 16, 17 years. Like that's also something that is the grace that I need to give myself of like, oh, I'm still identifying my own confidence in my day-to-day life. 'Cause there are some times when I find myself like masking part of my identity because of my comfortability, and I think that's what we ultimately, and with some of my other friends, what we'll talk about is that shared like kind of the code switching almost. And so I'm very grateful that I when I'm in that moment of maybe not in my most confident self version of myself, I can think of my dad and like that toast and being like, no, like that, like by me showing up and just even just standing in this room is a step towards being my authentic self.
Yeah, for sure. What I'm curious if you could like expand a little bit on or give an example of a situation where maybe you do have to code switch or where you aren't feeling like your most confident self, because I think for a lot of people they look at like an Emmy or an Emmy a Tony award winning sorry producer being
One
like, how
day,
could this
maybe.
Yeah, one day, who knows? An EGOT. How could a Tony Award winning producer ever not be confident? Or, how could someone, people just, forget sometimes that we're all human. And so I'm wondering if you could just maybe share with us a time where you weren't your most confident self and you felt like code switching was what felt right for you.
Oh, it is, often, especially in a space where, while I was sharing like the theater community, it is like a warm hug. There's so much embracing of who you are at the table, but simultaneously and historically, it's been a industry that's been upheld by a handful of white men, straight white men, and those are the scenarios where at times I can catch myself self-conscious about the way what I'm wearing or the way I'm speaking or the way I utilize my hands and when I'm talking and trying to communicate something I'm passionate about. And those are the moments where I clock, like, I think, is this because I'm in a business scenario that this is something that's, a stereotype of being held, like the power is held by these straight white men. And I even can share, like, with some of the women in my life who have also been in this industry for a long time, they have shared, we've had a shared kind of commiseration about what it feels in those rooms sometimes as not being in that demographic. And so I think that's the first thing that comes to mind of scenarios that I have felt like I've needed to code switch, and then taking a beat to just breathe for a moment. And I practice these, like, I work with an executive coach who she is so remarkable in giving me tools in those moments of self-doubt, of how to channel back into my breath and try and center myself to being that. I can I as cuss on this podcast, so, but
Oh yeah, please.
the joke that we have with each other is, like, whenever I'm in that moment, I say, I'm Sammy fucking Lopez, and in my head. And it's like, and then I think of these breathing techniques with my fingertips that I can do literally at a conference table. And so nobody even knows that I'm doing this breathing exercise if I'm in a room with executives who need me to show up a certain way, but I'm feeling like I don't fit in that room. And so I've been offered these tools that I work with my coach around how do you step into those scenarios with the confidence that is inherently in me. I just need to breathe to let it come out.
Totally. I had similar like workshops with a coach, Caroline Rothstein, and she there were a lot of like moments of like laying flat and like reading something that I had written, and she made me read it over and over again until it was actually my voice. She's like, you're projecting, you're not speaking from your gut. Like she could tell, and like helped me know what it feels like in my body when I'm actually using my authentic voice versus when I'm like quote unquote code switching. My kind of like what you're saying, like no one knows you're doing it, but you're doing it to like help you. Like move through and to find your inner confidence is I do. I have this picture of me in an avocado costume where I'm like going like this. I'm just like sun is in my face. I'm on the beach and I just like feel the most myself. And so my avocado pose is my confidence pose. And so I don't necessarily like I won't stand there with my arms wide like this, but I'll like stand and not, everyone no one can see me except Sammy. But I'll like stand there and I'll like go like this, like just like really subtly. And it's another tool, like similar to what you're saying, of like to remind me, no, I belong in this room too. I know what I'm talking about, or I wouldn't be here in the first place. And it's like it's great that we have these tools to help keep us grounded and centered, and to remind us that we deserve to be in these spaces also.
And I feel like that's what I try to share out, especially if someone comes to me with a similar question of, like, how do you show up in these rooms where they're, historically they just weren't made for us. So, like, and it's just like the bare foundation of, like, that's the fact. So now let's, like, use the secret sauce that we bring to the table to subvert that fact. 'Cause I think, the way we show up and the energy that we bring when we show up can shift these systems. And that's what gives me the drive, when I feel those moments of discomfort or lack of confidence.
Yeah, I love that. And I want to like shift to the work that you do because you I just, you do such incredible work, and it's like, it's to me, it seems like, and correct this if this is wrong, so much of what you do kind of just ties into what we're talking about of like making space for people's voices, for stories that aren't historically, centered in the Broadway and or the larger theater community. I don't know. I'm just like, how did you get into producing, and what has that journey been like with that lens of making space for folks who don't usually have space in the theater?
Yeah, I mean, when I first started producing, I didn't even know what the word producer meant. I started because I realized that within my friends and within my circle of friends, like we all had like things we wanted to share. And I naturally just became the person that got us together to make it happen. When I was in high school and there were Hurricane Katrina had happened, and my friends and I wanted to raise money to support some of the theater students that were affected by that. And we did a cabaret, and I put together the cabaret and, made all the pieces come together. And afterwards, our theater director was like, that's producing. And I was like, I don't know what that is, but that was really fun, but I still want to sing and dance. So I'm not a producer, I'm an actor. And then, time and time again, like more of these opportunities came into fruition. And then when I was in college, again, a lot of my friends who weren't cast in some of the main stage musicals, we all, would want to do cabarets or different types of things to give ourselves a platform to share our work. I tended to be the person that put it all together. And then it started to become, larger budgets and needing to request funds from the university to make certain things happen. And that's when I started to really identify, oh, this is actually something that not just lights me up the way I feel when I'm, singing a song or in dance class. It's like, this is actually a sense of like bringing community together, not just for my friends who are performers, but then adding the element of the audience. And that's when I get chills. Like even right now, like I'm like the idea of a dialogue between audience and artists is, I think, what my biggest goal is as a producer. And so that's kind of the trajectory. It just like naturally happened. And I happened to break my ankle, which I couldn't do a summer stock gig. So then I ended up getting an internship in general management. And that was the first time where I saw the financial side of an off-Broadway festival of new musicals, and my mind was blown. And I looked at these budgets and I was like, that's fun. Ooh, I love how like all of this comes together. And so just like piece by piece, organically, I just started to learn more and more about the making of an original show, like something from the script on and lifting it all the way to its, performances. And so I feel like overall, I'm really on a mission to like demystify what producing means, because I think all of us are producers in some capacity, because we all have something we want to say. And so my goal as a producer is to identify those that really have something that they feel like they're so passionate to share out with the world. And I'm just in ways like the conduit or the story doula to make it come together. And so that's really the center of the work of how it all comes down to like community.
I love that. Just like the organic journey that you've been on, and then just the fact that you are opening doors for so many other people is really incredible.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, And there comes a lot with that type of responsibility. And especially when, as I was just sharing, like the theater space, like a lot of the system was not made for a lot of the individuals that I'm eager to bring forward and center in stories. And so there's this responsibility of like, okay, now that we have the stories that are uplifting these artists that have never been centered in these pieces before, how do we support the individuals now that they're there? And that's the daily work that changes show to show, changes day to day, changes whatever's happening in the world or in our country, and how that's related to how people show up to work. And that's where the nuanced part of producing is the part that excites me the most. It's like when it's almost like I work with an organization called Theater Producers of Color. And on the first day of our sessions, I typically talk about like the setting of the table. Like for me and my family, like setting the table, was a big moment where we, you were thoughtful about how you put out the placemats, the like all the things. And I think of that as a producer. I'm like, it is my job to intentionally set the table, look around, who is at the table, and who needs support while they're eating? Who needs support? Who needs me to get them another glass of wine or water or whatever? Like, I think that's the part that it's getting the platform is step one, but like sustaining and supporting is really the work that lights me up the most.
Yeah. I just remember, so one of the shows that you produced is How to Dance in Ohio. And which you reminded me, we met at like the very early, like, what do you call it? Just like a table read? Is
It
that
was
what you
like
would call
a,
it?
yeah, just like a, it was like a sharing, like primarily for people in the community, potential investors, potential partners, and just friends of who are interested in supporting new work. It was like a gathering of sorts to just share out what we've been developing.
Well, it was lovely and I loved it. And I went with our friend David. And then I got to see, then David and I like saw it when it was on Broadway. And I just was blown away by, well, first, so it features a cast who are autistic. I don't know, is it, do they, would the folks in the your show use it in first person or like,
Yeah, we as we were developing the show, identity first language became the language preference of the company particularly.
And so, well, so even you, what you just said there is like you worked with the company to figure out what language felt best, which I think is like speaking to the work that you're talking about of like we're setting this table with these folks, and how do we make sure that the language that we're using is the most affirming? And I also remember, and this is, it's been a minute now, but remind me, like there were like sensory rooms and ways to set the audience up for success as well as folks in the company. And I just remember feeling just, I keep using the term blown away, but like I had never been to a show ever that took such care of everybody from start to finish. And it was just incredible. And so, have you, what, I guess, what, I'm just kind of rambling, but what was the re response from that? Because the way that you set that show up was so thoughtful. And like you're saying, you intentionally set the table from beginning to end. What was the reception? Like, were people like, I can't believe, like, just tell me about that.
Yeah, there were so many things that I learned on How to Dance in Ohio around simply asking an individual, like, what do you need in order to do your best work, in order to enjoy a show, in order to, feel good about coming to work? And so, It was a lot of just like coming down to the question of just ask, and so much of what was learned or created on that project, I've now brought into every other show I'm doing, despite the fact that most of the show other shows I'm developing aren't centering the themes of disability or accessibility. But I think accessibility supports everybody. And so there was so much on that project that actually has influenced everything else we're doing as producers. And I've also, when ultimately we did have to close on Broadway, I remember, chatting with everybody in the company and saying, like, all of us that were a part of this, now we get the opportunity to take what we learn from this, developing this original musical on Broadway and having accessibility built in to the fabric of the show versus it being an afterthought. We get to now bring that to all the other shows that all of us are going to be doing next. And our associate choreographer, she went on to perform in Hell's Kitchen, and some of the tools that we learned in How to Dance in Ohio, like she reached out and said, "Oh, by the way, we're implementing this into what's going on at Hell's Kitchen." Or another person said they brought this to what they were doing backstage at Anne Juliet or Tommy, the revival that was last year. And so I think that's the impact that I've started to see. People reach out all the time. We did these we called them just an access survey where we would send them out to the company before we get into the rehearsal room, a first day of rehearsal. And it's just a simple survey, really breaking down, preferences and just how we can set up the studio. And so it meets everybody's needs. Do you need a larger print script? Do you, like if it's cold in the studio, do you need a blanket? Like there's just like these simple things that our management team can put together. And by the time it's the first rehearsal, it's too late because we're all there in the space. So it's like, how do we think about it ahead of time and build this into the creation of the gathering? So that was the biggest impact, I would say. And it's something that I love seeing how people are adapting the language that we discovered on that project and just continuing to evolve, because the biggest thing I learned about particularly disability, A, is like a lot of people are scared to say the word disability, and I think that I've really felt comfortable in a sense of no, it we want to be able to voice the things that people need, and we want to be able, because ultimately then it's gonna help them stand in, just going back to the beginning of this conversation, like it'll help them stand in their confidence and show up in a way where they feel like they don't need to mask or they don't need to code switch in a conversation. And so that's really the impact that I think about from that entire process. And I just hope that everything we learn continues to evolve, because the conversation around disability is changing every day. And that is something that, I'm sure that some of the language we used in How to Dance in Ohio is going to be outdated. Is outdated at this point, having closed on Broadway a year ago, and then 5 years from now, it's like I want it to evolve as culture evolves.
I love that. It feels like a breath of fresh air because there are so many folks who are scared of change and scared of evolution. And the fact that you're embracing it is amazing. And I also just like you said you got chills earlier. I got chills as you were sharing this impact that the work that you did on How to Dance in Ohio, that you're having it in all these other shows. There's just like the ripple effect of this work. And I think a lot of folks maybe don't necessarily realize that when we are teaching Like when I do, like, I teach workshops around diversity, equity, and inclusion, and belonging, and deep. And I don't think folks necessarily realize the ripple effects that we can have. And so it's really nice that you're receiving the messages back of like, oh, I'm implementing this and I'm implementing that. Because that to me is just one other just really important facet of storytelling is like, because I would say that that's, the pre-work, the setting the table, that survey, that is integral and it's integral to the main story. And I think it's also a story in and of itself, like the story of making work accessible to and making it's just it's amazing. What was I gonna say? I lost my train of thought. It
Well,
happens.
another thing I wanted to share, because you brought up the audience experience, and
Yeah.
this past Friday, I was at the Times Square Alliance office, and the head of the Times Square Alliance came to see How to Dance in Ohio on Broadway. He loved it, and he, helped us spread the word. But because of that audience experience of having sensory spaces in the mezzanine and the lower lobby, for Times Square's New Year's celebration this past year, he implemented sensory spaces in Times Square for the people that were going to the ball drop in the middle of Times Square. And so when I saw him on Friday, I knew that he was doing that. So I asked him, I was like, how did it go? Like, because they basically got these vans that they brought into Times Square, and those vans, like, you could go inside them and utilize if you needed to have just a chill space. And he said that it was a hit and people utilize them and that they're coming back again for next year. And he was like, and I still think of, like, it was because of sitting at the Belasco Theater and seeing how there were those sensory spaces is why we're now gonna keep this as part of the Times Square tradition for that event. And I'm just like, that is the kind of like the wow of it all, of like, oh, that is exciting, and to see how that will evolve is something else that just reminds me that the power of these types of stories is crucial. It's crucial.
Wow. Seriously, I teared up a little bit as you're sharing that because that's huge. I mean, how many people go to Times Square? Tens of thousands of people. And the fact that they're now implementing sensory like spaces and places like chill zones, that's like amazing.
Yeah.
Sammy, that's amazing.
I mean, it's, and it, what does it come down to? It's just like the idea of, like, just like thinking of, like, who are we here to serve, and how do we ultimately give the buffet of options, not telling people, like, you need that because you have this, you need this. It's like, no, here's the options that you can choose from. Maybe I'm, like, hungry for dinner, because if I'm talking about setting the table and talking about buffets.
Yeah. We'll have dinner soon enough. So you have a couple of really big projects coming up that I'm super stoked about. The first one is Call Me Izzy with Jean Smart. You were telling me about it that night, the magical New York night. But tell our listeners about this show that's going to be debuting soon.
Yes, yeah, we start previews very soon. It's a one-woman play that stars Jean Smart, and it's directed by Sarna Lapine, and it is written by Jamie Wax. And Jamie Wax is, this is going to be his Broadway debut. And the story has been in development for many, many years, as most original works do. And the piece is actually inspired by his aunt, and his aunt in this case is Izzy or Isabel, and who is played by Jean Smart. And the play is, it's truly a solo show. It's a you're sitting in Studio 54 for 85 minutes with Jean Smart portraying Jamie's aunt. And the piece ultimately centers Izzy, who is basically trapped in the circumstances of her life. She lives in a trailer. She does not have access to many things that I think most Americans receive, and so she's really stuck in this marriage. It's not a great marriage; it's a toxic marriage. However, she finds such empowerment through poetry and reading, and she becomes really inspired to start writing her own poetry. And because she needs to conceal this from her terrible marriage, she writes her poetry in her bathroom of the trailer. And she ultimately discovers her resilience and self-empowerment through the words that she's writing in this enclosed space, where she ultimately writes herself out of the marriage and is able to find a writing opportunity at the nearby public library that wins her a fellowship award. I don't want to give any spoilers, but she ultimately builds that resilience to find her voice and, kind of rise above the circumstances that she's in. And all of this is like, it's a very theatrical piece. It's very poetic. We have an incredible design team that's bringing the piece. But Jamie, the playwright, his background is in stand-up comedy. He works for CBS. He has had a whole career writing for stand-up comics. And so the fact that there's this like very what sounds like a very deep story, and it is, but paired with this like stand-up comedian background that he has, and Jean Smart's wit and brilliance in how to navigate text. It's such a beautiful marriage of storytelling, because Jean takes you on a roller coaster. It's like at one point she has you like cackling and laughing, and then at the next point, like there's like a pin drop, and she's like so in the moment of like, I need, like the stakes are high here. And so she's hasn't been on Broadway in 25 years. And so it's amazing to me that there's this actress of Jean's caliber who wants to come back to Broadway, and the way she's coming back to Broadway is by uplifting a Broadway debut playwright and utilizing her almost like celebrity status to bring forward new voices. And so that's Call Me Izzy. It's only on gonna be at Studio 54 for 12 weeks. So it's a limited run this summer. Jean really wanted to come back to Broadway, and I just feel so fortunate to help be a part of that. And our amazing partners, well, I'm producing with my P3 team, and then also Rob Ahrens, who is also the producer of Little Shop of Horrors off Broadway, as well as Just in Time, which is at Circle in the Square. So it's a really great team, because we're all there truly in service of how we can make Jean's return as amazing as possible.
Wow, that's incredible. I definitely need to see it while it's playing. So I'll keep
Yes.
you posted when I go.
And it's just Studio 54. Come on. It's like the history in there and the cheetah carpet that I'm obsessed with.
I've never been.
Oh, well. We'll
I know.
see you
That's
on 54th Street.
yes, you will. That's amazing. And so I mean it I would imagine that the piece that Jamie wrote really spoke to Jean, or Jean wouldn't have signed on in the first place.
Yeah.
So that's really special to find that the like match of like this is something I want to come back and like bring to life. That's really cool.
I mean, I think that's when you can feel, when you can feel like artists deeply want to do something, like they have that itch of a story they want to tell. Everyone involved, like the way that Sarna is elevating the piece, as a director, it's just all of these artists are at the top of their game doing a story or creating a story that's a world premiere on Broadway. It's like we get the chance to bring a new play into the American theater canon. And the fact that Gene chose this play is really freaking cool. And so yeah, I mean, it's amazing to see that passion. And I think something a part of the story, it's like there's this central theme of the power of libraries and the power of like how libraries have played a role in society, and especially for the various socioeconomic levels of individuals. It's like it like I think we have lost sight of like how important libraries are to the fabric of our country. And so this story kind of reinforces like libraries are windows to other parts of the world that some people will never get the chance to see, but they get that chance through literature. And so I've recently become re-obsessed with libraries, and I'm actually like trying to figure out some partnerships with the local libraries right now for the show. So it's, you know, I shared earlier, just like the it's always about like how we can get the themes of these plays and connect them to like the things happening in society, and particularly how we can galvanize audiences to leave a theater feeling like they're reflective and can be in many ways reactive.
Yeah. How do you do that? So like what are like I'm just thinking of 'cause I think about this a lot, which is like, you know, seeing theater can really move can and does move, you know, it moves us, it changes us, it changes our who we are at a molecular level. So then how do you as a producer kind of I don't like this word, but I can't think of another word, capitalize or like, okay, I'm feeling really inspired by How to Dance in Ohio, or I'm feeling really inspired by Call Me Izzy. And then when the theater goer leaves, it's kind of like, well, now what? How do we keep them engaged in wanting to stay present with the themes and with the feelings from that show?
I mean, I think of it as building a menu of options, of levels of engagement, because I sometimes think of our audiences as in three buckets. So it's skimmers, swimmers, and divers. And so you can think of like the audiences that are the skimmers are the people that like bought a ticket, they wanted to see the show, they leave, like it was a great night at the theater. The swimmers are the people that like see the show and they're like, oh, like I will stay for the talk back, or I will look on the website for, you know, more context of like what the show is based on, or you know, the level of engagement that feels not too much of a commitment, but it takes effort to like take a look at what was behind the making of this piece. And then the divers are like the people that really want to sink their teeth into it. It's like why we, you know, I always like to create a resource guide on our show websites of thinking about how you're utilizing your social media pages to further engage your audiences pre and post show, email lists. It's like so I try to give a little bit to each of them, each of those buckets. But for those divers, for those types of audience members, it's really thinking about strategic partnerships with organizations that are doing the work of the play, because there's only so much we can do. Every show on Broadway is essentially a mini startup company. And, you know, you really sprint to get it all together. And so I don't have enough time to actually build out the resources, but there are so many organizations that are at our fingertips that are eager to partner with the Broadway show. And so it's almost like not building it fully from the ground up, but using this story as the opportunity to uplift the work that's happening in the community. So I think those are ways I view audience activation after they see a show.
I love that. I love that it's also you have that you've kind of like you figured out the various level of engagement and are catering to each one. And that's brilliant.
Yeah, well, it's something I learned when I was at Center Theater Group in Los Angeles. There's a theater that they run called the Kirk Douglas in Culver City, and they essentially had the best lobby engagements I've ever seen. And they talked about like we need to build lobby engagements that are for all types of audiences. Like, some that are like the interactive and then some that are very like passive low stakes. So, you can decide how you want to engage with the story, which I really credit what I learned when I was at that theater company.
Yeah, I love. I'm at a loss for words. But what I want to say is, what something that what I don't know if you are realizing it or not, but a central theme of everything that you're talking about is this, comes back to choice. And it's like for the when you're giving the survey, pre-show, you're giving folks accessibility choices of like. Because you are this, you need this. It's no, like, here are all the options. And now, even for the audience, you're like, here are all the options. And I just think that that's amazing that you are continuously going back to this idea of like, there's not a one size fits all. And it's probably why all the work you're doing is so successful, is because you're not sticking into one, lane that, would only fit a certain kind of person.
Yeah, thanks for saying that.
Yeah, absolutely. So tell us about these Pride plays. So they're happening during World Pride, and then there's going to be a day in New York City on June 23rd. So what's the impetus behind Pride plays, and how do
Yes.
we get involved?
Oh my goodness, Pride Plays is like my like passion project that Doug Nevin and Michael Urie and Nick Mayo are three colleagues of mine that I met years ago, and they launched Pride Plays in 2019 with the effort to increase queer representation in the development of new work. As theater has started to shift in terms of like the developmental opportunities granted to playwrights, it's starting to just dwindle more and more. And so, Pride Plays was kind of created to help fill in some of the gaps of like, all right, if all these developmental opportunities are starting to diminish, like where can we step up? And particularly around queer work and thinking of shows like The Inheritance by Matthew Lopez or The Normal Heart by Larry Kramer or so on and so on. It's like, it's who's supporting those artists so that we can have the next Angels in America. And so Pride Plays really was created with that intention of just like, this is a space where we can support and fill in the gaps of like where there's not as much developmental efforts happening. And so the Pride Place has really evolved because it happened successfully in 2019, and then the pandemic hit and it went totally virtual. And last year was the first year where it happened again in person. And Rattlesick Theatre Company has been a huge supporter of the organization as our partner. We're able to do the readings in the West Village at the heart of where the movement began, per se. It's like, so it's an amazing org. And going to DC this year is a huge opportunity for us because we're a small little team that is somehow now creating six plays in rep that are going to be performed at Woolly Mammoth Theatre Company, which is to me one of the like leading organizations in DC that is pushing the boundary of what theater can be. So it felt like such a match of missions of ours, and so they've given us their entire theater space. So we have three different theaters. There's going to be three different plays happening at any given time. And then the lobby's going to turn into a fun queer ass space with DJs. We have the gay men's chorus that's going to kick off with a pop-up choir concert. And, I'm just trying to curate a celebration amidst this time in, particularly in DC during World Pride, when funding is getting cut right and left, Pride events are getting cut right and left. Like, this is kind of going back to this idea of the power of resilience, the power of like our stories are necessary and matter. And I'm really excited about the plays that we've programmed. It's a good mixture of DC playwrights, DC artists, and we have some legacy pieces coming as well. And so it's this kind of dialogue between where we've been and where we want to go.
That's awesome. That sounds amazing. And folks who want to go to DC or to come see shows in New York City on the 23rd, how do they find tickets?
Yes, it's prideplays.com, and with the plays are free, and we build that intentionally so that theater should not have a barrier of entry per se, especially for these queer new voices. So yeah, we encourage people to join us. We're excited about our New York City step, because there's going to be one piece that's going to be performed in both locations, so in DC and in New York, and it's a playwright that I'm super pumped about, and I think is like has a really fresh voice, and so all of the programming is going to be featured on prideplays.com, so you can check out what sparks your interest, and that's the goal, is if you come to a Pride Plays production or Pride Plays reading, you are introducing yourself to a new queer voice that ideally will create the next, boys in the band.
Wow, that's cool. Being part of history in the making.
Yes, and having fun too, because all of our shows end with a gathering, a post-show gathering, because if we aren't gonna hang out and have a drink or, a talk back or moment to just share what we just listened to, what story we heard, like that's a critical part of this community building that Pride Plays has in its mission.
I love that. You should tell Priya Parker.
Yes.
Tell her about all the different ways you're gathering folks.
Yes.
So I really want to keep talking and I want to be mindful of time. It's almost dinner time for both of us. So I'm going to bring us into our lightning round of questions that are meant to be for fun. They are open-ended, so they're a little bit harder, not harder, but they take a little bit more brain power to answer, because I was lovingly called in a few years ago that my questions were too binary. But there is one that I could not get rid of. But there are no right or wrong answers. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. Where is your favorite place to think?
Riverside Park.
Who is an influential queer person in your life?
Dan Guerrero, who is my Gaytino. I call him my abuelita number two, but he is based in Los Angeles, and he created this solo show called Gaytino about the just coming to terms with your full identity and your full self, and both from me being a Latino, and he's also Latino, like, and queer. It's just Dan Guerrero, look him up. His father was Lalo Guerrero, who was the quotes father of Chicano father of Chicano music. So he's the person immediately that comes to mind.
Oh, I love that. Definitely will re do some research. What is a song that you can listen to on repeat forever?
Oh my gosh. Dancing in the Moonlight. Dancing
Which ver
in the Moonlight.
I love that song. Do you have a specific version that you like?
This the classic. I can't even tell you what, just the one that is on my Spotify playlist.
It's probably King Harvest, but there's another version by Olive Klug or Klug. That's great. So I would check that one out.
Yes.
Great song. What's one thing you want to be known for?
Continuously staying curious, giving some Alice in Wonderland curiosity.
Love it. What does identity euphoria feel like to you?
Rolling in the fields in with grass that is just bustling with flowers.
Love it. Where do you find joy?
Oh, on the couch with my husband and puppy.
That sounds lovely. All right. The main event here, bagels or donuts?
Oh, donuts.
Well, the correct answer is bagels, but there are no correct answers, so donuts is fine. Do you have a donut spot that you like in the city?
Oh, not in the city. I will take any donut in the city, but where I'm from in Los Angeles, there's this place called Rose's Donuts and near my parents' house. It's like I feel like in LA there's just a better selection of donut options that are like mom and pop shop donuts, 'cause in New York that's all like a little bit more corporate. So I think that's the vibe. It's like an LA donut shop. But I guess on the East Coast I would choose bagels. So just to go back to the last question, I'm split.
Yeah, I guess the context matters.
Yes.
Sammy, thank you so much for joining and for sharing so much of your wisdom and your heart. Just really appreciate you and thank you for coming out.
Thank you. I appreciate you. And I just look forward to seeing how your message and work continues to inspire others too. So appreciate this time.
Thank you. Thank you for coming.